Well, hello everyone and welcome to Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I am the host of this show. We've been pretty heavy on budget and economics over the past few weeks, well, for obvious reasons. So this week, I wanted to take the conversation on this podcast in a brand new direction. My guest in the studio is Shane Rattenbury. He is the leader of the ACT Greens. Now, unusually in the federal context or the national context, Rattenbury sits in the Labor cabinet in the territory government in the ACT. Last month, after a great deal of advocacy on his part, the ACT conducted the first pill testing trial in the country. Now, that took place at the Grooving the Moo Music Festival here in Canberra. And strangely, look, harm minimisation happened and the world didn't end. I've been quite interested in this story as I've been preoccupied by the budget over the past few weeks. How did it unfold? How did it come to pass? So Shane's kindly agreed to pop up the hill and join me in a second to unpack what's occurred behind the scenes and what's the likely developments as a consequence of this one pill testing trial. He and I will also catch up on energy policy towards the end of our conversation. That's something of a mutual obsession of ours. So listen up. Shane Rattenbury, thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning.
Now, I want to talk about pill testing, and I'm going to say up front to you that I have absolutely no idea about this debate, how it's come to pass, your involvement in it, and I thought it would be of interest to the listeners if I ask you a bunch of dumb questions about pill testing and we talk that through. So take me through this story from the beginning, your interest in it and what's come to pass over the last little bit that has seen the ACT conduct a pill testing experiment at a major music festival. Let's start from the beginning. So your interest.
Sure. Well, pill testing is recognised as an important harm reduction strategy. And when you look at drug policy generally, it's recognised that you need three pillars. One is supply reduction, so intervening with the dealers. The second is demand reduction, so encouraging people not to take drugs and providing programs. And the third is harm minimisation. And that's the idea that people do get involved in drug-taking behaviour and that we should make sure that the harm arising from that, the health consequences, are minimised as much as possible. So pill testing very much sits into that last category. It's not about condoning drug-taking. It's, I guess, operating in the real world that says people will take drugs, particularly young people are going to experiment with these so-called party drugs. And we need to make sure that they don't die from it, essentially. I don't want to be dramatic about that, but we have seen examples in Australia where young people have taken these tablets and have passed away, and or more commonly have ended up in hospital with serious health problems. And so that's what we're interested in seeking to avoid.
Mm-hmm. And your own interest in it, though, your own interest in the issue, how did that start?
It really came from, I guess, from a frustration that in the real world, people are undertaking these kinds of behaviour. And we've got this approach to drug policy in Australia that's been very much about trying to outlaw it. It's the classic war on drugs. And that simply hasn't worked. And I'm not comfortable with the fact that there are good strategies out there that can minimise the risk. And we've seen pill testing operating overseas very successfully. And I think you can measure that success in a number of ways. But we've seen it operating really well. And in Australia, there's been a reluctance because of that long-term view around how we approach drug law and drug policy.
Mm-hmm. And because you're a Green in a Labor government in the ACT, obviously the Greens have a more, well, certainly at the national level, have a more permissive policy. I mean, permissive isn't exactly the right word, but you know, it has a, have a more aggressive harm minimisation policy than Labor does federally. Is this an issue you picked up and took to your Labor colleagues? Because obviously you sit in the cabinet in the Labor government in Canberra. Is that how it happened?
Was it? It was. I first brought this to the Assembly probably 3 years ago now to sort of say, look, this is a strategy we should think about in the ACT. And there were some excellent medical advocates around who were prepared to back that up and actually operate a service. And so we had the combination of, I was happy to drive the policy discussion, and we had the people capable of delivering a pill testing service. It'd be fair to say that the initial reaction from both the Labor and Liberal parties in the ACT was the traditional one you would expect in terms of Australian drug policy debate. And that was disappointing, but I continued to work on my cabinet colleagues. And I think individually they could see it, but there's that, I guess, that traditional barrier. What really made a difference in the ACT was when it moved from being a law enforcement discussion to being a health policy discussion. And the health minister got the chief health officer involved. So the sort of independent senior medical official in the ACT who actually went off and did a piece of research and came back to the government and said, actually, this really makes sense from a harm minimisation point of view. And I think that really changed the discussion at a political level.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, the attitude of ACT policing. They acknowledged that this and accepted that this is a good harm minimisation strategy and briefed up their minister to say, actually, we are supportive of this as well.
That's really interesting. So did the police buy in from the get-go, or did they need to be persuaded that this was an appropriate harm minimisation strategy?
I think there was a few factors. The police are not a homogenous group.
No, sure.
And there are different views in the policing, but certainly the senior leadership were brought on board. And there have been a number of senior former police officers who've really been involved in this conversation as well. People like Frank Hansen, former Commissioner Phelan. These people who've spoken out very strongly saying we need to take a different approach. I think their influence has also played an important part in helping to shape police views.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, as you say, the chief medical officer can work on the health minister, the police can work on the police minister, and slowly you can come to terms. So when did you decide that you would launch a pill testing trial at a major music festival in Canberra? When did that happen?
Yeah, the Cabinet took the decision in September 2017. Now, in Canberra, we only have two major music festivals a year. We have A Spilt Milk, which is sort of in the late spring, November, December, and then Groove and the Moo in the autumn at the University of Canberra. So the decision was taken in time for the Spilt Milk Festival in 2017. To be honest, I thought once we had government approval, that would be
enough.
The key barrier broken down, because event organisers previously said, look, we'd like to do it, but until the government endorses it in some way, we're not going to go there. Now, the government didn't perhaps explicitly endorse it, but it removed all of the barriers. We identified that there was no need to change the law. You can do pill testing in Australia without any legal changes. It really is a matter of government policy and then cooperation with the police, who have that discretion. They exercise it every day in the way they think about the law, the same way they don't arrest people who go to safe injecting spaces because they acknowledge the harm minimisation factor. And again, they'd taken that position here. So we had all of those, if you like, official ducks lined up, and I thought that would be enough. What was very interesting then was it didn't go ahead at Spilt Milk in 2017. Everybody had thought it would. And there's still conjecture about why not. But I think the fairest summary is, at the end of the day, the promoter formed a view that he did not want to take the risk of having it at his festival now.
And why is that? Because I must say, I sort of thought about this, you know, just the practicalities. If I'm a kid intending to take party drugs at a music festival and I take myself along to the pill testing tent, it's sort of, in my head, it's sort of almost self-incriminating, that behaviour, isn't it? On the part of the kid, because the kids are, you know, teenagers are always paranoid, obviously, about authority figures of any kind uncovering their recreational habits, right? So that there might be some element of concern about self-incrimination. Is that what the festival organisers were worried about, that it might sort of cast a pall over proceedings, or was it a liability issue, or what was it that made them hesitate?
Look, it's not clear. There's questions of whether there was a level of political overtone on it. Certainly our local Liberal Party and the ACT were very opposed.
Mm-hmm.
Spilt Milk takes place on Commonwealth land in the ACT, so the National Capital Authority, which is a federal agency, gives them approval to use the site or not. There's speculation as to whether the promoter was fearful of losing his permit because of the sort of conservative influence there. The issue of self-incrimination you raise is a really interesting one. That's where having the police support is so important. Now, the setup around these things is the police will still continue to operate outside of a festival. They will still seek to catch people bringing drugs in. They'll particularly target those that are dealing. But the police have been very clear that they will not use the medical tent as a so-called honeypot. Now, the way these things are set up is the pill testing sits within the medical precinct, and so the young person can be going along, they go in the medical tent, they might be going to get a Band-Aid for a blister, or they could be going to the pill testing. That's how it's set up, as sort of part of building that trust. But also with the police support, they have that confidence. What we saw, just to skip ahead, when we played out at Groove and the Moo in Canberra this year, is I think people were wary early in the day, and I think a few people went in with what might be considered legal drugs, you know, pharmaceutical type drugs, went through the system, worked out that they weren't going to be targeted in any way, came back later And so I think a few people might have been seen in as guinea pigs, just watching the way it practically played out.
What, bringing your antibiotics in or something?
Yes, yep,
right,
yep.
Run that through the system.
Yeah. Young people are smart. They sort of, because this had never been done, there was a degree of being uncertain. And I think some people did test the system to see that it was okay. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, news travelled fast that it was okay. The trust was built and we did see quite a high usage rate of the service.
And so what were the stats in the end? Who used it and what did you discover?
There were 85 samples tested on the day. About 120-odd people came through. So some people came as groups. Some people came just to seek information. So that's why the number of people is higher than the number of samples. What we saw was it operated like it does overseas. It operated exactly like we expected it to. On the day, two potentially lethal drugs were identified. Mm-hmm. That was very serious. And they were drugs that had not been identified in Canberra before.
And when you say lethal drugs, what do you mean?
Drugs that have been associated with significant health problems overseas, drugs that have been involved in people having serious medical reactions and in some cases leading to death.
And did the kids know that was the drugs in their possession? Did they understand that was what they were taking or going to take? Or what I'm trying to say is dealers misrepresented the product to them. Did they think they were, you know, just going to take?
They'd absolutely been misrepresented. I mean, most people turn up thinking they had an ecstasy tablet.
Yeah, I was going to say.
To quote
the teens, you know, they come in with their pingers, right? And they discover it's something
exactly.
else entirely.
And that's the most important part of this whole process is it's actually about talking to the young people about what's actually there, giving them information and talking about the risks and realities of these drugs, the fact that they are often made up in dodgy backyard labs. They're not always what they're represented to be. And so the outcomes were, aside from the two quite serious cases, there were also a range of tablets that certainly were not what people thought they were.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them more benign. They're in fact a rip-off, if you like to put it that way, from the dealer because they contained not the psychoactive substances they thought they were getting.
Mm-hmm.
And so you saw the full spectrum, and that's a really important part of the pill testing is that it's run by medical experts, not by law enforcement, not by parents. You know, it's really this objective information-giving process which talks about the risks and the potential consequences of taking these tablets.
Mm-hmm. And what were the kids given the results on the spot? Did they know what the tests showed?
Yeah, so the way it works is they come in, they have to sign a waiver, they explain what's going to happen. As part of the research of this, they were actually asked what they thought they had before it was tested.
Mm-hmm.
They were then asked later what the contrast was.
Yeah.
But then essentially a tablet is photographed and measured and weighed. That's part of the information gathering. Then a small scraping is put into a spectrometer.
Mm-hmm.
This spectrometer is connected to a massive database which can analyse all of the components in the tablet. And it takes 3 to 5 minutes for the machine to do its work. And the medical professionals there can say, well, this is the active ingredients in it. And they talk the young people through what's in the tablet.
And what were the reactions on the spot?
A lot of surprise, I think. A lot of people getting what they weren't expecting.
Mm-hmm.
Some did get what they expected, and I guess they were pleased about that. What we did see, some people discard their drugs, having been told what was in them and it's not what they expected. There's actually discards, and we've seen that again overseas. That is a common reaction. Also, there was an information board put up about what some of the tablets had been. And so, again, that was part of the giving of information.
Mm. That's interesting. What's been the community reaction in Canberra? Obviously, Canberra's a pretty progressive city. You know, if you were going to conduct a pill testing experiment without people coming forth with their pitchforks and saying how horrendous, this would be the place to do it, I guess. But what has been the community reaction?
I guess there's probably a couple of different measures of that. Certainly on the day at the festival, the numbers were much higher than the team had perhaps expected. They feared they might not get many because of that lack of trust. So the word got around, and certainly the young people who came through the tent were very positive about it. They were appreciative of the service. They were disappointed it hadn't been there before. They wished there'd been more signage so they could find it. It was quite low key for this mm-hmm. first time around.
Mm-hmm.
The general community reaction has been, I think, overall quite positive. And we've certainly seen that ripple around the country where, for example, in Tasmania, we saw the Tasmanian AMA come out and say they wanted to see it in Tasmania now for some of their major festivals. Generally, in Canberra, it's been quite positive. We did see one very uncharitable letter to the editor a couple of days afterwards in the local paper that said, these people are taking the risk, they get the consequences they deserve. And they actually produced this flurry in response of strong support. So I think overall the community reaction has been quite positive.
And how do you set about, presuming this is your objective, building a broader constituency for this. You've said, obviously, you know, the AMA and Tassie came out and said, we'd like to see this in our music festivals. How do you try and progress this as a national conversation? I know the weekend after the music festival was held, there was a little bit of playback into federal politics with a couple of MPs coming out and expressing views either for or against it. What do you do? Do you try and get it on the COAG agenda? How do you progress it? Assuming you want to, of course.
Oh, we definitely want to progress it. I mean, I think it worked. A part of it will be the fact that it did actually happen. It took place. It worked like it was supposed to. And I think that's been the key thing. Always doing something the first time is the hardest. And, you know, there will now be a formal report come out of this. There are researchers attached to that. So that evidence base will be important. You know, here in the ACT, the support was significant. ACT policing, the ACT ambulance service, the University of Canberra, where the festival took place, supported it. The promoters ultimately were very positive about it. I think they were nervous coming into it because of issues of liability and insurance and legal consequences. But having had it now happen for the first time, many of those questions and fears and barriers have been broken down. I think the most likely scenario, our next step will be to see it become a regular feature at music festivals in Canberra. There's also questions about whether it should operate as a more permanent service. Now, I visited the Netherlands last year when I was on leave and went to a pill testing facility there. They've progressed their model over the years. They've been doing it for a couple of decades now, and it now runs as a clinic at about 30 sites across the country, just on a Wednesday and Thursday night, and people come in. I think given that music festivals are not the only place where people do take these drugs, having it more consistently available is perhaps one approach you could take as well. Being in Canberra City on a Friday and Saturday night with a tent could be another option. I would also hope other jurisdictions across the country would now take this up. There are much bigger festivals in other places, and now that we've, I guess, broken the barriers here, I'd like to see other governments take it up. But it requires a degree of political will, and I guess a degree of political courage to actually get it done.
Because it's who's responsible? It's state governments, obviously, presumably. Well, the festivals are happening in their jurisdictions, so presumably it requires state governments to take it up.
It does tend to, because things like the police service, the ambulance service, the approvals for land use, all of those sort of things tend to come at that more localised level. That's where the approval would come from.
And where do you think the main sort of resistance, I mean, obviously you've mentioned the Liberals locally are very opposed and presumably still opposed, even though this has occurred and obviously there's been nothing untoward associated with it. Is it political resistance that's the main barrier to expanding this around the country, do you think? Or, you know, the medical profession, you mentioned the AMA in Tasmania. What's the AMA's position on it nationally, for example? Do you know? Because, obviously there's the medical fraternity is quite a diverse group, you know, very conservative people, very progressive people. So where do you reckon the main resistance is still?
I think the main resistance is a political one. There are others who oppose it. I mean, anybody who takes the view that the war on drugs is the right way to proceed and this is a law and order issue is likely to be opposed to this. I think the AMA has historically had real concerns about this. I'd like to think that as the evidence builds, both from overseas and now from within Australia, they would reconsider that opposition, and certainly seeing groups like the Tasmanian branch come out and support it, I think, is part of that shift. So I think it really is in the political space.
And what about a privacy question? I should have asked you actually when we were talking about how it played out at our music festival, but the kids that are coming forward with their samples, do they have to identify themselves? Is there any markers about who they are that's kept in a system somewhere? Because obviously you need to collect evidence and data and produce facts, produce a scientific kind of basis of evidence in order to have this conversation. Are there any risks for people in fronting up?
No, I don't believe so. And that's a very important part of building the trust. And certainly the way the team operated on the day, whilst people had to sign a waiver, that was kept securely. One of the interesting features they ran here at the Canberra trial, and I believe this is one of the first times this has been done, is that individuals who did have their drugs tested were given a wristband. And the wristband simply had a number on it, so number 10. And what that meant was if the person later on did take the drugs and had an adverse reaction, there was an understanding between the ambulance service and the pill testers. The ambulance service could ring, and if they found someone with a wristband on, they could ring the medical team running the service and say, we've got number 10. So it wasn't we've got Dave Smith, it was we've got number 10. What did you test for? And that would help them in responding to a medical emergency. So, again, people seem to really embrace that. So there's a degree of common sense amongst the young people. They don't want to die from taking these things. They want to have a good time, but they don't want to end up with a serious medical consequence. So they're willing to take a bit of a risk, I think, in terms of privacy, or be open about that, knowing that there is protection there as well.
Okay, and as I have you in the studio, we are here to talk about pill testing, and I hope that conversation's been will explain to a lot of listeners exactly how this has unfolded, and it's certainly been helpful to me, who knew nothing at all about it when we started having this conversation. But you and I have a major interest in common, and it's energy and climate policy, and obviously the ACT is one of the jurisdictions that will determine the outcome of the National Energy Guarantee over the next couple of months. Where are things up to with that?
Well, as you recall, we had the COAG meeting in Melbourne, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago now. It's been quiet since then. That meeting agreed that the work would continue to develop the scheme. And so we are now awaiting the further work by the Energy Security Board. I think what's become very clear to me out of that COAG process is there's two clear streams of work going on. And this wasn't so clear coming into the meeting, but it's now crystal clear. There is the work being done by the Energy Security Board, which you might describe as the technical work, the rules-based work to improve the national energy laws. And our overall impression is that's going reasonably well. Some of the early concerns that came from the paper last year have been ironed out. I think there's some quite positive developments in that technical rules space. Then there's the Commonwealth policy paper, and that is really where the controversy is going to sit. That is the paper that will address issues such as the level of ambition in the emission reductions targets, whether offsets are used, whether additionality of state action is counted. And so I think we're seeing two quite different streams develop, and how those are going to either come together or be dealt with separately, to me, is going to be the key to the politics.
Okay. And any predictions on that score, how the Commonwealth brings that together?
Well, I think the Commonwealth is making it very clear that they don't intend to move on some of these issues, despite the constant message that we all have to compromise, we have to be open to getting this work because it's so important, it's in the national interest. The Commonwealth have been the ones most adamant, stating that they would not shift their positions on some of these key issues. What's also interesting is that the Federal Minister, Josh Frydenberg, is now being clear to the state ministers that if we get agreement at COAG, he still has to take it back to his party room. And so from a political point of view, we could come to an agreement, but there's still a veto hanging over us from that federal party room. And so how all that is going to come together is entirely unclear at this point.
Well, it looks entirely unclear. I wondered if you had any particular insights, but it doesn't sound like it.
No, and I think there has been a quiet patch since the COAG meeting. That will start to ramp up again soon. There is set to be a phone link up in June. And so we'll start to see things move forward. But I think the next play has to come from the Commonwealth. They need to give some indication of what the roadmap to getting an agreement is going to be. From a state and territory point of view, we'll be looking to see some of those outstanding issues, which have been well discussed before, how they're going to be resolved and what the propositions are.
And that you raised some particular concerns about the treatment of ACT or wind farm supplying power to the ACT. Are you confident that there can be a technical fix for that, or is that still up in the air?
No, I am confident we can resolve that. Both the Federal Minister and Kerry Schott, as the head of the Energy Security Board, understand that issue. They've said they believe it can be fixed. It's in the grand scheme of the whole system, it is a smallish issue, a very important one for us, and I'm confident that that can be resolved. And I think that sits in that bag of technical issues that can be ironed out.
And what's obviously, well, you can sink this, the ACT can sink this in the event that it chooses to, because that's just the structure of the national energy market and how these conversations go. But what's the disposition, do you think, of Victoria and Queensland, who will be also critical, I think, in deciding whether this flies or doesn't fly?
Yeah, I think overall it is fair to say that all of the jurisdictions do want to get an agreement, and that's been stated by everybody. It's, I don't think, a great secret. But the threshold for what that's going to look like is the hard part, and that's where there's no obvious roadmap at the moment.
Well, but if let's try and think about it briefly. Obviously, the Commonwealth can't raise the level of ambition in the emissions reduction target for the National Energy Guarantee without the party room basically running over Josh Frydenberg. So that 26%, I think that's a take it or leave it proposition in the real world, right? But is there some other way that the Commonwealth could address the concerns about additionality and other things with the state governments? I mean, I can think of one way, for example, but I don't know whether or not that would be sufficient.
Mm. Look, I think there are options. For example, one of the key questions will be, can that target be ratcheted up if there was a change of government? And that will be a threshold question, I think, for a lot of people. The other question that remains to play out in my mind is how the Federal Coalition Party Room examines this question of the pro rata allocation of emissions. And we saw Michael McCormack make some comments just before the last COAG meeting. We've seen the West Australian government identify these issues. And for your listeners' sake, this is if the electricity sector only does 26% of emissions, it means everybody else needs to as well to meet our Paris targets. So the transport sector and the agriculture sector would have to cut their emissions by 26%. And that's much harder.
Well, it's more costly.
More expensive, frankly, more politically difficult, if not impossible.
Yeah.
And so how the Federal Party Room is going to reconcile that issue of saying we are going to meet the Paris target, but we're not going to get as many emissions out of electricity as we probably could in the most cost-effective way, I think is a really big question that may shape actually how the Federal Party Room thinks about this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, anyway, I think it's fair to say that this issue is going to run for the remainder of the year, one way or another. I think we'll get you back later in the year and we'll talk some more. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Catherine.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We really do appreciate it. Don't forget, if you like the listening, to subscribe either via iTunes or your favourite podcast app, and share the program if you like it. You can also leave us a rating or a review. Thank you, as always, to Miles Martignoni and his production folks in Sydney. He puts this episode out every single week, and we're very grateful for it. We'll be back again next week. Parliament resumes for a 2-week sitting. We'll see you then.